times.
I'm going to call this meeting of the Elections Committee to order. So a quorum is present. The first item on the agenda is the approval of the minutes. We have 2 minutes. So first is the minutes of the February 14th, 2024 meeting. May I have a motion to approve the minutes for February 14th?
So moved.
Representative Frederick, thank you. Is there any discussion? Seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye. Aye.
Aye.
Opposed? Motion prevails. Next is the minutes of the February 21st meeting. We have a motion to approve those.
So moved.
Thank you, Representative Frederick. Representative Frederick moves approval of the minutes of February 21st. Is there any discussion? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, motion prevails. We're going to switch up the order of the bills on the agenda here. We have a member who is slightly delayed who wanted to be here for one. So Representative Egbaje is going to go first with House File 4043. Would you like to move, Representative Egbaje, that House File 4043 be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, Mr. Chair.
Okay, the bill is before us. Did you want to move the DE1 amendment to start?
Yes.
Okay, is this just to put the bill in the shape you'd like it?
Yes, that's correct.
Any discussion to the amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye. Aye.
Opposed? Okay, the bill is in the shape you would like it. To your bill, Representative Egbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and committee members. Today I'm presenting House File 4043 as amended by the DE1 amendment. It's also known as the Prison Gerrymandering Reform Bill. So prison gerrymandering is an unfortunate flaw in our census data collection system that over time has led to imbalances in the population count. When the census first began, the main concern was the relative population between states, as that was the data that was used to determine representation in the U.S. House of Representatives. As the United States grew, states started using the census population data to determine local jurisdictions and their state-level representation. This meant that jurisdictions that contained prisons could count incarcerated persons as residents and attain a boost in representation based on imbalanced numbers, without the participation of the incarcerated people in the community of that prison. It meant that the home communities where prisoners had come from would lose their portion of political power in the state based on population. While the Census Bureau has not yet decided to act on this, states across the country are using their power to reallocate the data that comes in from the census every 10 years to ensure a more accurate count. This bill lays out that for the 2030 census and beyond, the Minnesota Department of Corrections and the Legislative Coordinating Commission will begin to reallocate incarcerated persons in state and federal prisons to the census blocks where they came from, rather than to the jurisdiction of the prison. The Department of Corrections will collect the addresses of incarcerated persons, the address that was the one immediately prior to their incarceration, send that data to the LCC, and the LCC will then reallocate the known address of each incarcerated person to the census block of their home community. This is important because most incarcerated people do not reside in the communities where the prison is located, and once released, will return to the place from where they were arrested. The data collected will closely track the census categories so that the LCC can properly reallocate people to the census block where they came from. For those without a last known address, or an address outside of the state, or those who do not wish to provide an address, the incarcerated person will be included in the statewide count for Minnesota. By starting now, we can prepare for the 2030 census and ensure that Minnesotans are being counted and represented fairly. And with that, I'll turn it over to testifiers that are available, and then take questions afterwards.
Thank you, Representative Egbaje. The first testifier on the bill is Secretary of State Steve Simon. Welcome to the committee. Secretary Simon, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I don't know if I could put it any better than we just heard, but I think this is a chance for the legislature to fix a distortion. And this is something that many other states have done recently. We'd be hopping on a pretty fast-moving and growing bandwagon. There are several states across the country that in recent years have done what this bill aims to do, so-called blue states, so-called purple states, and so-called red states. In fact, the most recent state to tackle this problem in a comprehensive way was the state of Montana. So this bill seems very much like those bills in the other states. It does fix a distortion, and it does recognize that people who are incarcerated aren't like other people in the community in the sense that they're not using the services, they're not part of the community of the place where they're incarcerated. You compare it to other transient populations like students, for example, who live on college campuses. They are part of the community. They do use the local services. And so this is really fixing an injustice, fixing a distortion, and this bill is very much in line with what other states have done. So we have an opportunity to do it now, and I really am glad that this is under consideration now in a year ending in four, because when you start talking about redistricting issues in years that end in 8, 9, or 0, it tends to get more political. Now, with the distance of time, we can really think about this issue and do as other states have done, and as I say, fix this distortion in where and how political clout is allocated. Thanks very much.
Thank you for your testimony. We have a few people who've signed up. First is Lily Sassy, excuse me, and then Wintana Melikan will be after Lily Sassy. Okay, Lily may not be testifying, it looks like, so Wintana Melikan. Okay, Wintana does not appear to be here either. Lada Knott. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. I'm Letha Knott. I am a senior legal counsel at the Campaign Legal Center, which is a nonprofit that's dedicated to protecting and strengthening the democratic process across all levels of government. CLC is also engaged in advocacy across the country to promote democratic reform and ensure that justice-involved citizens have access to the ballot and fair representation. So through this work, we've seen firsthand the urgent need for reforms like this one, which would help to end prison gerrymandering in Minnesota. Prison gerrymandering distorts the democratic process by counting incarcerated individuals where they are incarcerated rather than where their legal residency is for the purposes of redistricting. Election officials in jurisdictions that house prisons represent large populations of people, disproportionately low-income people of color, who have no connection to the area, who cannot vote there, and who have no friends, family, or community of interest that can advocate on their behalf. Prison gerrymandering artificially inflates the voting power of districts with prisons while disempowering communities where the incarcerated individuals lived before and where they will ultimately return their legal residence. And because districts are drawn once every 10 years, these skewed population counts are locked in place for the next decade. Prison gerrymandering also disproportionately harms communities of color in Minnesota. Black people make up 35% of Minnesota's incarcerated population, even though they only comprise 7% of the total state population. So as a result, prison gerrymandering in Minnesota denies many communities of color where these individuals are from fair representation. Minnesota has an opportunity to join a growing national movement to abolish prison gerrymandering following the lead of 11 other states. We urge you to support this legislation. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify regarding this bill? Okay, seeing none, we can turn to member discussion. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for bringing this bill forward, Representative Akbarje. Just a couple of questions. First, the Secretary mentioned that there's that incarcerated folks don't use local services. I'm not sure that's 100% true. They do. They're in the district. Water and sewer and things like that are part of the local jurisdiction. Have you examined the potential impact to the local jurisdiction where these prisons are located as these potential citizens are counted elsewhere?
Representative Badger.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you for the question, Representative Torkelson. You know, I think the purpose of this bill is getting at the idea of how are we ensuring that the data that we're collecting from the census is allocated appropriately and used for its intended purposes. So in the jurisdictions where there are prisons and across the country, we've seen this regardless of which jurisdiction it's in. What's happening is that prisoners who while they may be using just the immediate, like water and sewer, but they're not really participating in other ways in that jurisdiction. They're not really interacting with their representatives in other ways in that jurisdiction. And then what's happening is that jurisdiction gets an inflated count. You know, I think some egregious examples across the country where in New York, they have a number of prisons in upstate New York. Many of those people don't live in upstate New York, nor were they going to stay in upstate New York upon their release. And so that created a distortion with how their Senate lines were their state Senate lines were drawn because of the increased population in upstate New York versus other parts of the state. And so I think with this bill, that's what we're trying to do to prevent that from happening. And so that way every jurisdiction is adequately counted and adequately represented across the state.
Representative Ferguson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Well, thank you for that. And I don't disagree with your description, but at the same time, at census time, we often hear from those that are trying to get everybody to participate in the census that participating in the census will assure that those services that your district depends on will be adequate based on the population that's counted. And if you don't participate, if we undercount districts, then they don't get their fair share of some distribution of funds for a variety of things, a couple of which we've already noted. So I think there is a potential impact, negative impact, on the districts where these prisons are located. It perhaps does not carry as much weight as what you're trying to do, but I think it's something that should at least be considered as we move forward with this bill.
Any additional comments, questions? Okay, seeing none, any closing remarks, Representative Agbaje?
Mr. Chair, I just had one more question.
Oh, sure.
I'm
Representative Torkelson.
It's early, I'm a little slow.
Yeah.
As far as determining the address for these prisoners, many of them will be easy, and I assume that the data will be kept protected as this moves forward. But for those that don't have an easily identifiable or verifiable address, how will they be handled?
Mr. Chair?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Torkelson. That is an excellent question. We've been talking about that continuously with both the Department of Corrections and the LCC. So where we've determined now, and you know, we're also continuing to take input from folks, is that the data would be collected that's based already on what's been given to us by the court system, which is sometimes pretty relatively accurate. I think the Department of Corrections is saying that they have about 65% addresses from the current prison population. And then for the addresses that we don't have yet, we'll be looking at ways to have people self-report, similar as they would in a census or as they do on many forms. We would standardize those forms so that way we're collecting the same type of information for an address. In the bill, it also talks about for those who may have been homeless prior to incarceration that they similarly would pinpoint their address based on where they most recently stayed and if those are cross streets or a shelter. And then, as you noted, the data would also be protected under the data privacy law. So we are looking at all of those ways to ensure that the data collection is accurate and cross-checking it with the various databases that we have. But that is, you know, a suggestion that we continue to fine-tune as this bill moves along.
Representative Torkelson?
Thank you. Just a final question. And this data probably doesn't exist, but any idea what percentage of prisoners once released from prison return to the address that they were associated with when they were in prison?
Representative Agbaje.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Yes, I think it's the majority of the prisoners. I don't have an exact number off the top of my head. If someone in the room does, they're welcome to say it. But what I've seen from reports is the majority of prisoners go back to where they were before.
Thank you. Any additional questions? Seeing none, any final remarks, Representative Agbaje?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you to the committee members. Appreciate your time today as we move forward with the continuation of this bill. You know, we'll be continuing to take input to fine-tune it, but what we really want to do is match with about 14 other states that have already started this process to reform how we allocate the count of people across the country, and we want Minnesota to be a part of that. So thank you very much.
Thank you. With that, Representative Agbaje renews the motion that House File 4043 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Agbaje. Representative Greenman. All right, Representative Greenman has House File 3527, the Minnesota Voting Rights Act. Representative Torkelson, we do have a fair amount of testifiers, so I think we'll be okay with the time on that one. Okay. And here's Representative Quam, right on schedule.
Right on time.
Representative Greenman, would you like to move that House File 3527 be re-referred to the Judiciary Finance and Civil Law Committee?
Yes, I would, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thank you. And would you like to move the A3 amendments?
Yes, Mr. Chair, I'd like to move the A3 amendment.
Okay, and this will just put the bill in the shape you'd like? Okay, any discussion to the amendment? All right, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the amendment is adopted. Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. I'm grateful to be here this morning to present the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, a bill that codifies the protections of Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act into Minnesota law while strengthening, streamlining, and updating it to make it more efficient, effective, and less costly. The Federal Voting Rights Act of 1965, which the DOJ calls the single most effective piece of civil rights legislation ever passed by Congress, works to ensure that the right to vote and participate by the 14th and 15th Amendment are not denied because of race. That is the goal of the Minnesota Voting Rights Act, to guarantee Minnesotans the opportunity, the equal opportunity to vote and participate in the process. Enshrining these protections into Minnesota law has become increasingly urgent in light of the Eighth Circuit decision that upending decades of precedent holds that Minnesotans themselves can no longer challenge racially discriminatory laws and redistricting practices under the Federal Voting Rights Act. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will ensure Minnesotans can vindicate these essential protections to combat racial discrimination in voting and strengthen them to respond to the threats faced by voters of color today. It improves upon the Voting Rights Act by establishing streamlined and predictable causes of action that will reduce the need for and the cost of litigation. The bill also improves on the Federal Voting Rights Act, providing a safe harbor to voluntarily resolve potential violations without litigation. The time to do this is now. Minnesota has taken great strides to strengthen our system of free and fair elections and our pro-voter election rules. We take pride in our strong participation in election administration. But like many of the metrics in Minnesota, significant racial inequalities still exist in voting participation and representation in our system. Minnesota's history and public and private discrimination against Native Americans, people of color, and language minorities, and the racial disparities that persist today continue to impair the opportunity of Minnesotans to fully and equally participate in our process. As the House the Select Committee on Racial Justice in 2020 reported, Minnesotans' persistent racial disparities are some of the worst in the nation and are measured by racial gaps across systems in unemployment, income, wealth, incarceration rates, arrest rates, home ownership rates, mortgage lending rates, home appraisal rates, test scores, reported child maltreatment rates, out-of-home placement rates, school discipline, air quality, life expectancy, maternal and infant mortality, morbidity, and even drowning rates. Those racial disparities exist in participation as well. According to the census in the 2020 election, 79.9% of non-Hispanic white citizens voted, but only 66.1% of black citizens, 64% of Asians, 62.7% of Latino citizens, and while the numbers aren't available right now from the census, there's also disparity with Native American voters. As we protect and strengthen our state and local election rules and administration, it's critical that we ensure that no Minnesota voter faces the effect of discriminatory laws or procedures. That's why, in partnership with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund, other civil rights organizations, We've drafted the Voting Rights Act to ensure Minnesotans have access to a private right of action and strong legal protections against voter suppression and vote dilution in Minnesota. We have learned from the six other states that have already adopted State Voting Rights Act, and the bill does three things. And I'm going to turn it over to Matt to walk through the bill. But in essence, it codifies protections against laws that would have the effect of suppressing or diluting the vote of a protected member, a member of a protected class. It provides an opportunity to fix the discriminatory practice or procedure without going to court, and it ensures that the law is applied consistently with Minnesota's history of making voting more accessible. With that, Mr. Chair, I think I'd turn it over to Matt Gehring to just quickly walk through the bill.
Thank you, Representative Greenman. Matt Gehring, please.
Mr. Chair, I'll just do a walkthrough of the bill, not in any detail, but just to orient committee members to where to find relevant sections of the bill they might be interested in. So starting at the top of the bill, Section 1 is the title. This is the Minnesota Voting Rights Act. Section 2 is the set of legislative findings. There are both details here that find past discrimination in Minnesota in various...
Representative Greenman?
I just want to note that the bill as amended... Okay. Yep.
Matt
Gehring. So, Mr. Chair, in this section, there are details here that provide evidence of past discrimination in Minnesota and then also connect that past discrimination to current public policy and the purpose for this bill. And as Representative Greenman just noted, in the author's amendment, this section is reorganized and moved to the end of the bill, but the general substance of the section remains the same. Section 3 of the bill is a set of definitions for various terms that are used throughout the bill. Section 4 on page 5 is a section related to construction and use of authority. So this is a section that directs how state laws and local laws must be construed in favor of the right to vote, as well as how local officials and state officials must use authority directed to them by law for election purposes, again, in favor of facilitating opportunities to vote by qualified individuals. Section 5 is the substantive prohibitions that Representative Greenman mentioned. Subdivision 1 of Section 5 is the standard for prohibiting voter suppression in Minnesota, and Subdivision 2 is a standard for prohibiting vote dilution. And there's both a standard for finding within Subdivision 2, there are standards for what constitutes vote dilution and how what types of evidence must be shown to state that claim. On page 7, Section 6 provides additional relevant factors that a court must consider or may consider when determining whether a violation of the law exists. So Subdivision 1 are factors that the court is permitted to consider. Then there are several other more detailed subdivisions later in that section about particular circumstances that the court may consider when determining whether evidence is appropriate or not. Subdivision 5 at the bottom of page 8 is a list of factors that the court is prohibited from considering when determining whether a violation has occurred. Section 7 on page 9 is the pre-suit notice section. So this is the section that Representative Greenman mentioned that requires a potential plaintiff to provide notice to the political subdivision before filing a claim. And the that notice requirement is in Subdivision 1. Subdivision 2 is the requirement that the political subdivision work in good faith with the person who filed the notice letter to remedy the potential issue that has been raised. Subdivision 3 authorizes the Secretary of State to approve remedies that the political subdivision might not otherwise have the authority to do on its own. I would note that the A3 author's amendment reorganizes that subdivision pretty substantially, so I'd point you to that document for the language there. Subdivision 4 at the bottom, starting at the bottom of page 9, is the set of standards under which a pre-suit notice letter would not be required. And then on page 10, subdivision 5 of that section is where you see standards for reimbursement of costs to the potential plaintiff for preparing and submitting a notice letter. And again, in the A3 author's amendment, this language is substantially modified. Section 8 provides some sort of procedural matters related to the judicial process that would apply in claims under this act, including who may enforce the act, preliminary relief if the claim is filed right prior to an election. Section 9 is a remedies section, so this authorizes the court to order remedies that are best tailored to mitigate the violation, and also to consider remedies that have been ordered by federal courts or other state court jurisdictions on on similar sets of facts or similar violations. And then Section 10 is a fees and costs section that permits the award of fees and costs to a prevailing plaintiff if they end up winning in a court proceeding. And then last is the effective date. This bill will be effective immediately. And then I also point to one other item that's in the A3 Authors Amendment, which is permissive authority for statutory cities in Minnesota to move from at-large to ward-based elections if they choose to do so.
All right, thank you. Representative Greenman, should we go to testimony?
That'd be great.
Okay. So the first testifier on the list is Secretary of State Steve Simon. Welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair and members. Steve Simon, Minnesota Secretary of State. I'm here today in support of House File 3527, the proposed Minnesota Voting Rights Act. The reason that we need a state-level Voting Rights Act stems from an alarming decision last November by the U.S. Court of Appeals for the Eighth Circuit. That's the federal circuit in which Minnesota sits, along with six other states. So this is our territory. And the court in that territory issued an alarming, distressing opinion last November. So here's the backstory. Here's the history. In 1965, as we all know, Congress passed the Voting Rights Act, one of the most celebrated pieces of legislation on any subject in American history. I bet if you polled history teachers and you said, name the top 10, what are the biggest bills Congress ever passed, this would definitely be on that list. Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act created a remedy for, quote, denial or abridgment of the right to vote on account of race or color, end quote. So in other words, Section 2 is where you go if there's a denial or abridgment of the right to vote because of race or color. It gave people across the country a day in court as a pathway to prove allegations of discrimination in voting. This was their day in court, Article 2. Before the Eighth Circuit decision last November, there was never a question anywhere in America about who had the right to bring a lawsuit to enforce Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. The common and unquestioned assumption nationwide was that both the government and private parties could sue under Section 2. In fact, over the past several decades, hundreds of such lawsuits have been filed by private parties, including several that have reached the U.S. Supreme Court. All along, and in all of those hundreds of lawsuits, no court anywhere in America, including the U.S. Supreme Court, ever challenged the common understanding and the common practice as to who could bring a lawsuit under Section 2. The November 2023 decision by the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals changed all that, ruling for the first time in America since 1965 that there is no private right of action under Section 2, that only the government can bring such cases. And by the way, if the government doesn't want to bring a case, if the Attorney General of the United States, depending on who that person is, doesn't want to bring a case, then everyday citizens are out of luck. So it would mean that an alleged victim of alleged discrimination would have no other way of challenging a law or practice under the Voting Rights Act. Now, another circuit court in another part of the country recently rejected that same argument. So they ruled the opposite of the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals, which means that the U.S. Supreme Court now seems very likely to hear the case to resolve the dispute and make a final decision on the scope of Section 2. Now, our office happens to be leading an effort among secretaries of state nationally to help reverse the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals decision. We believe the case was wrongly decided. But in the meantime, the Eighth Circuit decision is the law of the land in Minnesota. So today, as we sit here right now, there is currently no right of private citizens in Minnesota to even allege racial discrimination under Section 2 of the Federal Voting Rights Act. They have no possibility of a day in court to even bring their allegations to anyone. So we need an insurance policy in Minnesota. If we can no longer count on the Federal Voting Rights Act to allow private citizens to protect their own voting rights, then we need a Minnesota Voting Rights Act to fill that gap. And that's what this bill does. It fills the gap by guaranteeing a day in court, not an outcome, a day in court for Minnesota voters to defend their voting rights against laws or policies that they believe discriminate against them. Now, some courts might think they're right, some courts might think they're wrong, but at least they will have a day in court. So there are still details to work out in this bill. I want to be honest about that. Our office has been involved in many discussions with the numerous stakeholders about fine-tuning the language in this bill, and for that I want to thank Representative Greenman, not just for her flexibility on this issue, in working with local governments, for example, but for her overall leadership on this issue. But this bill is necessary to ensure that every Minnesota voter can bring claims of voting discrimination to court. Inaction is not a safe option. So I respectfully urge your support for the Minnesota Voting Rights Act. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony, Secretary Simon. I'm going to, we have a couple testifiers who I think wanted to come up together, Lada Knott and Michael Pernick. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony. We're asking testifiers to stick to about 2 minutes each. I guess since there's two of you, that could be four.
Two plus two.
Yeah.
Good morning. My name is Michael Pernick. I'm a voting rights attorney with the NAACP Legal Defense Fund. First, I want to thank Representative Greenman for sponsoring this critical legislation, and I want to thank the committee members for considering it today. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act addresses an urgent and critical need for protections against racial discrimination in voting. For decades, the Supreme Court has chipped away at the protections of the federal VRA, making litigation under the federal VRA complex, unpredictable, and costly. And we just heard from Secretary Simon, who powerfully explained the impact of the recent Eighth Circuit opinion holding that voters can no longer bring lawsuits directly under Section 2 of the VRA. As we know, black voters and other voters of color in Minnesota face substantial racial disparities in political participation, in voter registration, in turnout, and we know that there's significant underrepresentation of voters of color in local governments. These trends are often associated with racially discriminatory barriers to the franchise, such as insufficient polling places in communities of color, or redistricting plans that crack or pack voters of color, diluting their voting strength. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will codify, clarify, and simplify the protections of Section 2 of the federal VRA into Minnesota state law and adopt new provisions to enable efficient out-of-court resolution of potential violations. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will protect against voter suppression, such as polling place closures in communities of color or a failure to provide language access required by law. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will protect against vote dilution, such as at-large local elections that shut voters of color out of the political process altogether, or redistricting plans that manipulate local boundaries in a manner that dilutes minority voting strength. These types of protections have existed for decades under the federal VRA. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act codifies them into state law and simplifies the complex legal standards that have governed these claims so that they could be resolved efficiently and quickly. The Minnesota Voting Rights Act will affirm Minnesota's place as a national leader on Voting Rights Act by building on the success of a growing number of states that have adopted state-level VRAs, including California, Washington, Oregon, Virginia, New York, and Connecticut.
And we are over 2 minutes, just if you could.
Thank you very much for your time. I'll turn it over to my colleague, Lada Knott.
Okay, thank you. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself again and proceed with your testimony.
Sure. Good morning, members of the committee. My name is Lada Knott. I'm an attorney at Campaign Legal Center, a nonpartisan organization that defends and promotes voting rights, and successfully settled the first case brought under the Washington Voting Rights Act. As my colleague Michael said, my testimony today will focus on how the provisions of the Minnesota Voting Rights Act work to give voters and local governments alike predictable processes for protecting voting rights. This bill codifies into state law the right of voters to challenge voter suppression, laws and practices that deny them an equal opportunity to participate in the political process. As Michael said, an example of this would be a polling place closure. But this bill also clarifies and simplifies what's currently a very confusing and unsettled body of federal law to establish a clear legal standard for determining when a practice is voter suppression. Plaintiffs must prove that, well, they must either prove that the practice results in disparity in the ability of voters of color to participate in the electoral process, or that under the totality of the circumstances, the practice impairs their ability to participate. The MNVRA also codifies the right of voters to challenge maps and methods of election that dilute the voting power of communities of color and simplifies the very complex test federal courts have created for vote dilution to make it more administrable, predictable, and less costly. It requires plaintiffs to prove harm, and it requires them to identify a remedy that would mitigate that harm that's suffered by voters of color. This bill contains provisions that encourage voters and local governments to work together to remedy potential violations before resorting to expensive litigation. Before they can file lawsuits, prospective plaintiffs must send local officials written notice that their voting rights have been violated and give them time to proactively fix things. And finally, this bill empowers Minnesota courts to consider remedies proposed by all parties and choose one that's best suited to help the impacted community, correcting a flaw in federal case law that has led courts to give deference to the remedy proposed by the government that violated the community's voting rights in the first place. If enacted, the MNVRA would be a critical tool to protect voters of color from discrimination. Thank you for your time.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Janae Bates. And after Janae Bates will be Khalid Omar. Welcome to the committee. Once you get up there, please identify yourself for the record and proceed with your testimony.
Hello, and thank you, members of the committee, for having me. Many of you might know me as Minister Janae Bates. I am the interim co-director at Isaiah. I also serve as a minister at Camper Memorial United Methodist, but I'm actually here in my personal capacity as a voter. I am a proud Eastsider. I am in Ward 6, Precinct 7, where I have lived in my home for the last 5 years, where I have many neighbors who are Hmong and Black and Latino and white. And we are actually known as one of the most racially diverse wards in the entire state. And we also have a number of things that make us the top of things, including being the most income diverse, but also having quite a few neighbors who are low income and low wage. We also have a number of folks who are young. And we are, some may consider us a low voter turnout ward, but I consider us a high potential voter ward. And that potential is completely dependent on our voting rights being protected and our access being strengthened. And I have a personal story around this that I hope you all consider as you're thinking about this bill. For the last 5 years that I lived in my home, I have walked a 10-minute walk to my voting location every year since 2019 because we have an election every single year, and I make sure I go there to vote. Last year, in November of 23, it was the first time that I walked to my location, and it was not open as a polling location. I then had to look on my phone and find where my polling location was and walked 45 minutes to that place. That means that it took me over 2 hours to go and vote by foot in a place, again, where a lot of my neighbors actually don't have access to a car. This was completely unacceptable. I most certainly did not get that notice, and I can only imagine how many of my neighbors may have walked to their precinct to vote and then realized that they could not vote there, and either before or after realizing how far away their new location was, decided to go home. This is unacceptable. And this is a huge reason why we absolutely need to have this voting rights law in Minnesota. The federal law was about protecting and expanding our rights and most certainly protecting us from discrimination. This one example of, I imagine, to be many, is a huge reason why we need this in Minnesota. Thank you very much.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Khalid Omar. And after Khalid Omar will be Alex Hassel. Welcome to the committee. When you get to the table, please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Good morning. My name is Khalid Omar, and I live in Bloomington, Minnesota. I'm a leader, husband, organizer, and I've been organizing in the Muslim community for many years, educating people about their voting rights and translating for voters at their polling location. Unfortunately, despite having the right to an interpreter at the polls, I saw elders who pushed every inch to come out and vote, but were confronted with an experience that could scar them from ever possibly voting again. They received no support with their language barrier. They asked multiple times for support, and no one was able to help them. They felt humiliated and unsupported. And when they came into the polling location, I heard their frustration. And so, frustration in Somali, saying, "I knew it. We should not have struggled to come out, because this voting process, it's only for certain groups." And when I offered to translate for them, they had already decided to go home and not vote. Unfortunately, as much as I would like this to be a one-time thing, we hear these stories every year, year after year. I don't think that's how anyone here wants someone to feel about exercising their civic duty. The Federal Voting Rights Act was meant to prevent state and local government from passing laws or policies that discriminate against voters on the basis of race or language minority status. But the courts have ruled after 58 years that people no longer have those same protections. This bill would clarify these protections in Minnesota, a state that prides itself on high voter turnout and accessible voting laws, which we absolutely should. And also remaining clear that there are stark racial disparities in who actually registers and turns out to vote. While there are many factors that contribute to this likelihood, it is our responsibility to ensure that discriminatory voting practices and policies are not one of those reasons. I urge you to take stories like those elders and many others out there who can't be here today into consideration and pass the Minnesota Voting Rights Act. Thank you.
Thank you for your testimony. The next testifier is Alex Hassel, and after Alex Hassel will be Matt Hilgart. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, members of the committee. My name is Alex Hassel here on behalf of the League of Minnesota Cities. I want to first recognize the considerable amount of time that Representative Greenman has spent with local governments to hear our questions and concerns about the proposal as drafted, and we look forward to continuing those discussions moving forward as well. I also want to point to the letter in your packet on behalf of cities and counties that provides our position in much more detail than I'll be able to provide in these short minutes here. I'll just start by saying that the League is not opposed to a private right of action under a state voting rights act, but we do have some concerns in how the bill is drafted and how it would put local governments in a position of interpreting complicated voting rights law and attempting to provide appropriate remedies. Cities don't have much discretion as it relates to elections administration. Statute governs pretty much everything related to administration, from how many days they are open for absentee balloting and early voting, accessibility and facility requirements for polling places, and deadlines and notice requirements for nearly every decision a local government can make. Yet with how the violations are written in this bill, our understanding is that a local government could be found of a violation under this chapter, even if they are following everything in statute, indicating implicit but unclear obligations for elections administration. The pre-suit notice process would have nearly all Voting Rights Act claims begin with local governments, but we have only been able to identify a few hypotheticals regarding local actions, polling place concerns, redistricting, and at-large council formations, the latter two being ones that would likely need significant resident engagement beyond the timeline allowed in this section. If this section remains, we would want to see a separation from accusations that are based on state election policy and not on actions carried out by local election administrators adhering to state policies, potentially funneling those claims through a different process. We recognize the inclusion of the cost sharing and cap in the amendment, but believe that having local governments pay for these costs will disincentivize the good faith, easy remedy sought by this section, particularly because a claim at this point would not have been tested in court to see if an actual violation had occurred. This process attempts to make it easier to resolve concerns for voters, but we aren't certain that the outcome of this process would differ than the existing one of raising concerns directly to local government officials because of the questions it raises regarding how actions under this process could impact future litigation or precedent under this law. I'll end just by saying that we do appreciate that the amendment addresses some of our initial questions and concerns, but hope to continue working with Representative Greenman on finding the right role for local governments in this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. Next is Matt Hilgart, and after Matt Hilgart will be Munira Muhammad. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Mr. Chair, members of the committee, thank you very much. My name is Matt Hilgard. I work for the Association of Minnesota Counties. The Association of Minnesota Counties represents all of Minnesota's 87 counties. My comments will largely echo what my colleague Alex Hassel said from the League of Minnesota Cities, but I would start again by echoing our gratitude. Representative Greenman has given us a tremendous amount of her time, as well as the committee staff and nonpartisan research, to try to address some of the questions. And unfamiliarity is, I think, the big key word for our perspective as local governments right now as we read through it. The first, I'll go over a few things, and the first is critical, I think. We are supportive of the 1965 Voting Rights Act and the underlying premise that I think Representative Greenman is getting to, which is to provide and statutorily make clear that individuals have a private right of action. A few things on this bill, however. I think some of our concerns stem from the unfamiliarity of what language is used in the bill to state those goals. It would be different if it weren't 10 pages and it were one page saying those two things. The Voting Rights Act applies and there is a private right of action. However, we believe that it might go further and we are unfamiliar with some of the terms used. We also see that in this language there are some directions to the courts which seem to preempt or dictate what the court takes into consideration for evidence and frankly puts local governments solely responsible for defending outcomes. And that is a critical component of this legislation. It is violations based on outcomes, not necessarily actions. Actions that certainly will be taken into consideration, but as my colleague pointed out, actions which we might be able to say as local governments, these are dictated by state statute. So I think a good question for this committee as it goes further, that there's further discussion, is where should local governments be on the hook for saying, yes, this is a clear violation of a local government action, and where should it, in a mandate-driven state, a Dillon Law state where we are applying your laws that you give us, say, no, the state should actually be the one that's defending a certain violation. I want to say in closing, Mr. Chair, I like the pre-suit notice personally. I've told Representative Greenman like this. I am not an attorney, and so any kind of remedy where folks could get together and say, this is a bad outcome, let's change it, that's not the court system, I think is a really good option. I still think we're not there yet. This, as Ms. Hassel pointed out, this still basically says a government that enters into good faith conversation with citizens that are saying a violation has taken place, and they say, you're right, we didn't intend for that. Let's fix it. Let's do something different. There's still pain. So there is that disincentive there, and I think we got to figure that out. And if we can't, maybe it is throwing it back to the courts, but I think that it's great in principle, but we got to figure out what it means in person. So I'll close by saying thank you. I want to thank Representative Greenman. She's been a tremendous partner for local government election officials. We are proud. You would see local government election officials here today, except that they're still doing election work. They were emailing us late last night on various bills, and so in their stead, I am here. Happy to take questions if you have some.
Thank you. Next testifier is Munira Muhammad. Welcome to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Chair. My name is Munira Muhammad, and I'm with the American Civil Liberties Union of Minnesota. The ACLU is a longstanding organization devoted to preserving the individual rights and liberties enshrined in our Constitution and laws. We're here to speak in support of Representative Greenman's bill. I'm going to keep my remarks brief since I'll be repeating a lot of what's been said today. The Voting Rights Act is one of the most historic examples of civil rights law that this country has ever had. It's clear that our ability to choose our government is part of having a functional democracy. It's of the utmost importance that all Minnesotans have an equal and meaningful chance to have their voice heard without obstruction. The Voting Rights Act has throughout the years been attacked and whittled down to a concerning degree, and has been as has been said here, the Eighth Circuit Court of Appeals ruled that a private plaintiff cannot assert a stand-alone claim under Section 2 of the Voting Rights Act. This radical ruling goes against well-established precedent and calls into question the fate of the federal VRA and the protection it offers Minnesotans. At this critical time, Representative Greenman's bill gives Minnesotans the necessary state law tools to fight for their rights when violated through private right of action, prohibitions on voter dilution, voter suppression, and pre-suit notice for local governments, and tailored remedies. It's the ACLU of Minnesota's opinion that this will not open the floodgates for litigation, but rather have a clear and prescribed pathway for resolving voting rights cases. We at the ACLU will always support measures to strengthen voter protections and civil rights for all Minnesotans, and we urge the committee to pass this bill.
Thank you for your testimony. That concludes the people who have signed up. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify to this bill? Okay, seeing none, Representative Quam, would you like to offer your amendment at this point? Do we have time for that?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I would like to offer DE2. I liked the opening of where the federal election laws and the things passed. And my amendment basically says, Minnesota, it's past time that we actually comply with the Help America Vote Act, and that over 97% of people in the United States live where they are never denied a ballot. And this would have Minnesota comply with that and have provisional ballots so that no one that comes to a polling location couldn't get a ballot if there are some things that need to be checked or some questions on documentation. They get a provisional ballot, but they still get to, at that time, cast the ballot. And if the vast, vast, vast majority of the people have that opportunity and that protection and empowerment, Minnesota should actually abide by federal law and comply, and that's this amendment. Thank you.
Thank you. Representative Quam has moved the DE2 amendment. Representative Greenman, any comments?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. Members, I'd ask you to vote no on this amendment. It deletes the entire bill that we've just been talking about and heard testimony about. I'd also just say, I share with you, Representative Quam, the value that everybody on Election Day should be able to vote, and that's why we have same-day registration. What this would do is replace same-day registration with provisional balloting, put those ballots into a maybe pile. What we've seen with provisional balloting is many of those votes don't get counted. So with that, members, I'd ask you, you've seen this provision before. I think it's also pretty expensive. I'd ask you to vote no.
Thank you. Representative Quam.
Thank you. Just a clarification. There are states that had same-day registration with provisional ballots and complied with federal law. I think Minnesota is actually capable, just like these other, other states, of doing that. And again, I hope for support on this.
Any further discussion to the amendment? Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. Question for the author. You stated that provisional ballots aren't all counted. Isn't there a good reason for them not to be counted?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Torkelson. I think if you look at the data and the experience, provisional balloting looks different all over the country. And in most places, they have it because they don't have same-day registration. That's why it was added after the 2000 election, was because in Florida there was no registration, so people were turned away from the polls, and there was no way to know who was deprived of the right to vote. The thing about provisional balloting, it is possible your ballot will be put into the maybe pile. You might have everything you need, but if you don't come back and show it, that ballot will be discarded. So we in Minnesota, and we've talked about same-day registration a lot over the course of this committee, have a system that has worked that Minnesotans like, and I don't think now is the time to give it up.
Representative Torkelson?
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. We're in agreement. So there's never any legitimate reason for a ballot to be rejected in a provisional system?
Representative Greenman.
I am not an expert on provisional balloting or hypos, but I think if you look at the research on provisional balloting, what you'll see is same-day registration is a better system that Minnesotans rely on.
Representative Torkelson? Okay. Representative Davis.
Yeah, for the record, thank you, Mr. Chair. I'd just like to point out that I did speak to an election supervisor about this in my district, and she said if someone wants to cheat very easily, same-day voter registration is the time to do it. It's the easiest way to get away with it.
Representative Altendorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Just a simple question. How many other states offer provisional ballots?
Representative Greenman, if you know the answer.
I don't know the answer, but it sounds like you might.
Representative Altdorf.
I believe we're one of, it's a very, very small number of states that do not offer the provisional ballots. And so that's why it's concerning to us that the state of Minnesota is really out here on their own with no checks and balances after that same day ballot has been submitted. So what is your answer to the voters of Minnesota of how to secure our election on the same day balloting, but at the same time eliminating the provisional ballot?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think we had hours of testimony, and I know we heard from the Secretary of State last session about the system, the set of systems we have to both verify identity and the ballot. And I would point you to the fact that, you know, we're having a lot of conversation, but what this bill is about is ensuring that folks aren't turned away from the polls, aren't discriminated against, don't have disparities because of race. And we're looking at ensuring that all voters can vote. And I don't think that this provision does that.
Representative Altdorf.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Exactly. I think we're all on the same page, right? You know, we want everyone to vote. We want everyone to vote. But at the same time, we have to turn to the Minnesota voters and say that our elections are safe and secure. So by doing the same day, voting registration that we're doing, and then not doing the provisional ballots, which is wildly popular across the United States, except for in Minnesota, we do not have a checks and balance in place to make sure that those same day ballots are secure. So with you out taking this amendment, you technically cannot say to the voters of Minnesota that we have secure elections.
Representative Greenman, any comments?
I don't agree with that. This amendment functionally eliminates same day registration. What same day registration does is says you can register if you show you are who you are and you know where you live, and you are where you live, then you can register and vote. We've had that system since I think 1974, and Minnesotans like it. And so with this bill, it would cost millions of dollars to implement and put a barrier, and folks' ballots wouldn't be counted on election night.
Representative Davis.
Thank you again, Mr. Chair. I appreciate that. So I heard you testify. You want all voters to have their vote counted, correct?
Representative Greenman.
Yes.
Okay.
Representative Davis.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. But hang on. Don't we want all legal voters to have legal votes counted in the sense that, I mean, I would hope you only want legal citizens of the United States of America to be able to vote. And whenever I hear that, I want all voters to be able to have their vote count. I think, well, it's going to be all legal citizens of the United States of America, correct? Thank you, Mr. Chair.
Representative Greenman.
Let me clarify. Every eligible Minnesotan who's eligible to vote should be able to cast a vote and have their ballot counted. So, yes. I apologize for using shorthand. I said Minnesotan. I should have said eligible voter. And if you'd like to correct me, that's fine. But I think we're in the same place.
Okay. So, Representative Bonner, we should probably get to a vote on this amendment so we have time to discuss the bill as well. But, Representative Bonner.
Yes. I'll try to be brief, Mr. Chair. I just wanted to say, you know, that I think, first of all, we're talking about replacing the really good language of the bill with something entirely different, right? We're talking about taking out all of the pieces that we're talking about here, making sure that citizens have the right to have a voice if they feel they've been discriminated against, with a very small provision that doesn't necessarily do what it does. And let's just be honest, that very small provision is a very, very tiny subset of voters. It is very limited. And, you know, it puts additional barriers in the path of actual citizens to get the ability to vote. If you've just moved to a new place, right, you've moved within the period, and you want to come in with your utility bill to prove and your identification to prove you are who you say you are, you live where you say you live, and you are an eligible voter, we want to make sure that that vote gets counted. And I don't think that stripping out all of the good things we're talking about here, protecting minorities, protecting folks who don't have a right to speak up and who are often at a severe disadvantage with gutting an entire bill with something that we're talking about minuscule amounts. First of all, I think we do share the same value of wanting folks to be heard, but I just don't think that's appropriate, and I would urge members to vote no.
Okay, seeing no further discussion, Representative Quam renews his motion to adopt the DE2 amendment. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed? No.
No.
Okay, the motion does not prevail. To the bill, Representative Quam, then Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and just a few clarifications. First of all, the OLA, when they did a sampling audit after an audit on the registration system, found that 45% of the registrations were not checked 29 months after, and that when they were checked, as required by HAVA, Minnesota averages over 18% of those registrations being bad. And we're talking in election cycles over 16,000, over 15,000 bad registrations. And those are the ones that they actually did get verified. So when someone says minuscule possibility of issues, frankly, when we do comply with HAVA, we discover thousands upon thousands of bad registrations. And then the legislative auditor uncovered the fact that a lot of the registrations aren't verified. And I can send the entire committee several large documents that will support that. But going back to this bill, why I wanted the HAVA compliance, because I don't believe the current bill form is ripe. And part of that is the fact that standard operating procedure for the legislature is when a area is active in the courts, and this is active in the federal courts, we tended to wait for the clarification so that then we don't have, we align with the determination, or we then correct the final determination. Whatever we do as a state would only affect in the state elections, state courts, because whatever we do, if the federal courts and federal law determine differently in a federal court and federal election, that overrides. We saw that with the Supreme Court deciding that Colorado internally could not, with their, people decide to not let somebody be on the election. That's just the first one. And the testimony to me was a little bit surprising and shocking. I didn't know that Minneapolis and the Metro has been discriminating against minorities by playing games with polling locations and with a lack of translators. I'm used to, in Rochester, even during early election, we've had cooperation between, for example, the Somali community and others to have translators present, even during early election, to make sure that everybody has access and support. So that testimony surprised me, shocking how bad. And I the concerns about discriminatory districts being drawn, that worries me too. And I was pretty satisfied with the last two, three redistrictings statewide were okayed by judges, or out of a function of appointments from the Supreme Court to do that. So I would think that there wouldn't have been any discrimination and gerrymandering in those districts, because the actual judges that would be determining cases are the ones that determine those boundaries. But we have to make sure that we are compatible with the federal laws, and we also have to have it well thought out and planned out. There are some elements of this that I think are great and wonderful. I think there, again, are details of the current language that I would say would not be ripe, not sufficiently worked on to not cause confusion and issues. And I know that is an opinion of mine, and I know the author is very familiar with, you know, the law, especially election law. But so many times I've sat here and we've passed something and we've been all right, and then the next year a judge interprets it and we have to come back and clarify. And I don't want us in this important topic to, you know, have that hit us. But thank you, Mr. Chair.
Brief response?
Yeah, thank you, Representative. Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Quam. And I would love to continue the conversation further about the pieces of this bill you like, and reiterate that sort of geography. This bill protects the entire state of Minnesota. And so I think we hear stories in the metro and suburbs, and at Greater Minnesota, it doesn't really matter. It's about the voters. And the last thing I'll say about the issue of federal law, you know, the part of the reason we're codifying this in state law is because, I mean, as you know, and the sort of the law has been for 60 years, it's been evolving and sort of in some cases inconsistent across the circuits. And here in the Eighth Circuit in Minnesota, unlike all of the other circuits, folks don't have a private right of action. And so by putting it into Minnesota law and doing it in a way that we think protects and strengthens those values here, we can actually avoid having to sort of have our local jurisdictions try to interpret what is often inconsistent dictates and sort of laws in different circuits, which can increase the cost of litigation.
Thank you. Representative Bliss.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I have just various questions on the bill. I'll just kind of page through it. I'm going to use the original bill because I'd moved over the amendment.
Yes.
Page 4. Line 4.21, protected class. It states that they're members of a racial, color, or language minority group, or who are members of a federally organized, recognized Indian tribe. And then after that, it says including a class of two or more such groups. What is the including a class of two or more such groups? If you're under these, you're already a protected class, correct?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bliss. And this is following codifying federal law. And I think what that is doing is protecting what is called a coalition. And so if you have more than, and I will look to my federal voting rights litigators who know the Federal Voting Rights Act better than I do. If you have two or more protected class groups, it just means that you're talking about
I'm sorry, Mr. So they're doubly recognized in the protected class?
Representative Greenman.
No, I think I'm not sure exactly if I know what that means, but I think what it is saying is that if you have two or more sets of voters, of particularly voters of color, it is one protected class.
Representative Bliss.
Okay. And then the next section, 4.24 to 4.26. The polarized voting means voting in which the candidate or electoral choice preferred by a protected class diverges from the candidate or electoral choice preferred by other voters. That just simply means if they lose the election, correct?
Representative Greenman?
No, this also tracks from the racially polarized voting in the Federal Voting Rights Act. I may phone a friend briefly explain the standard and how that is measured, because it is not just simply losing an election.
Thank you.
Sure. Thank you, Representative.
Welcome back to the committee. If you could just briefly answer the question.
Of course. Michael Pernick from the Legal Defense Fund. Thank you for your question. This is drawn, as Representative Greenman said, directly from federal law. The concept of racially polarized voting is the linchpin of federal vote dilution claims. This was established in the 1986 opinion Thornburg v. Jingles from the United States Supreme Court, which set out a federal standard for vote dilution claims concerning redistricting or at-large elections. What this is basically saying is if you have a circumstance in a particular jurisdiction where voters of color prefer certain candidates and majority voters prefer different candidates and vote as a block to deny voters of color an equal opportunity to elect candidates of choice, then it's possible for the configuration of districts or the existence of an at-large election to shut out voters of color from equal representation. So that's why that's the crux of this question. It's looking at, are there polarized voting patterns in the jurisdiction? Because if there are, then that's what enables districts to be configured in a manner or a structure of election to shut out voters of color from representation. This inquiry has been used in literally hundreds of cases across the country. It's widely accepted, universally accepted across the country, across courts, from Democratic appointees, Republican appointees. This is the inquiry in federal Section 2 cases concerning vote dilution.
Thank you. And we would like, we do have one more bill on the agenda. I don't think it will take super long, but I would like to hopefully move to it by like 10 to 10, if possible.
Mr. Chair, I mean, this is a big bill and it's going to redo a whole lot of things. I've got lots and lots of highlighted questions. And again, I just had a quick question on that. And I understand, you know, that it might be precedent and that's fine. It might be good law, but I'm just trying to clarify it for myself and other people that may be watching. So you just said that a protected class, like a minority class, a community of color, their vote would be diluted by somebody voting in block and not allowing them to do so. So you're saying like the majority of people in that district don't agree with the protected class, so then that would be a polarized voting.
Yeah, let me give you an example, if I may.
Very brief response, Mr. Okay.
Imagine an at-large local election and a community that's 30% black. That 30% black community supports a particular candidate consistently. The 70% white community supports different candidates consistently. That's polarized voting. And because of the at-large election, that 30% of the community has zero voice in their local government because they're consistently outvoted by the 70%. So that's the concept that this is getting at. And that's where the Federal Voting Rights Act says if you have that scenario, that's potentially dilutive of the 30%. And there needs to be some different structure that gives that 30% some sort of representation.
Representative Bliss.
All right. I think it still says if their candidate loses, it's vote polarization. Voter suppression, I have a real quick question on this one. It looks like this one on Section 5, 5.21, looks like it might be applying to voter ID. Is this particular section going to preclude us from establishing a voter ID in Minnesota?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Representative Bliss. Because this is a state law, it actually wouldn't, at this point, apply to acts of the legislature.
Oh.
Because you can do it, federal law can apply to acts of the state legislature, but it is, there's sort of an awkwardness of us binding future legislators.
And I'll keep them short. This is probably the one I have questions on the most. I think this redistricting would impact this. So if the next election redistricting cycle elections, there'd have to be two, the election resulting in impairment of the equal opportunity from a protected class to nominate or elect their officials of their choice, which is what we discussed there. And based on the totality of circumstances, the equal opportunity or ability to protect a class member to nominate or elect candidates of their choice. You know, after any redistricting, there's going to be a minority number of people, I'm using that and the numbers, that don't like who was elected after the redistricting. Is this going to bring on a flood of cases of voter suppression?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, and I think you're talking about the vote dilution on subdivision two. Okay, and I would say no, and I think you can look to the history of under Federal Voting Rights Act, which this is codifying claims that are currently available under Federal Voting Rights Act, and that has not been the case. These are very hard cases to prove. to show this. You have to actually have to do a pretty significant, and that's part of why we have the litigators here, analysis and expert review. It's why, one, there's not a ton of them. And so I don't expect, and I think you heard from the ACLU Minnesota, who does voting rights litigation, that they're not expecting a flood of litigation. And I don't think that the history of other states that have passed State Voting Rights Act show that either.
All right.
Yeah, okay. I've said enough.
Any additional member discussion? We have spent an hour on this bill. Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. This is an extensive bill, and it brings up a lot of questions. I'm sorry we have questions, but we do. So if you can allow us to
proceed with your question, Representative Torkelson.
Thank you. I would like to focus a little bit on what the League of Minnesota Cities and Counties brought up, and that is this issue of when they comply with all of the legal procedures necessary to conduct an election, and the outcomes then are used against them. How does that work?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and thank you, Lee Torkelson. That's currently how, when we have facially neutral laws, that's currently how Civil Rights and Voting Rights Act claims exist right now. So if you have let me take at-large elections, just because we've been talking about it. If you have a state law that says, and this is why we're changing the law in this bill, but if you have a state law that says Minnesota statutory cities have to be at-large elections, can't change, and then that is shown, right? You can prove up and show you have a claim for vote dilution. Under the current Civil Voting Rights Act of 1965, when we had a private right of action, you would sue that local jurisdiction, you would go to court, and you'd litigate that out. What this bill is doing is saying, one, let's have a pre-suit notice so you can try to resolve it up front, and then if the litigation has to go to court. That's the current procedure. I am interested if there's a different procedure, and I've been talking to the cities and counties pretty extensively, but right now on civil rights, on voting rights claims, you sue the place where the decision is made or where the impact happens.
Representative Torkelson.
Well, thank you, Mr. Chair. So we can make a law here at the state of Minnesota. The local jurisdictions can follow it to the letter, and then they get taken to court and have to spend local resources to defend themselves for obeying the law. Is that kind of the crux of it?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is the way that it currently works. So this bill wouldn't change that. It would just follow that. And
Representative Greenman, you're defending that? You think that's the proper procedure? That's how way we should do things?
Representative Greenman.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. That is, I think, how it's done across the country in jurisprudence. So I would entertain a different way to do it. But right now, just this bill is not intended to change the entire way that we litigate cases like that or civil rights, voting rights cases. Interested in talking more about it with you.
All right. Thank you. Any closing remarks, Representative Greenman?
Thank you, Mr. Chair, and I really appreciate this conversation. This bill has more stops, and so Representative Quam, I'd like to continue talking to you for folks who want to continue talking. There's lots of work to do with all the stakeholders. We're hearing from local voting rights litigators. We're hearing from cities and counties. I think what is important here is that we're protecting the rights of all Minnesotans to vote and really paying attention to the history that we have here in Minnesota and the disparities so that no one is denied their equal opportunity to vote because the federal courts have taken away their ability to go to court. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for your support.
Thank you. With that, Representative Greenman renews the motion that House File 3527 as amended be re-referred to the Judiciary, Finance, and Civil Law Committee. All those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Opposed?
No.
Okay, the motion prevails. Thank you, Representative Greenman. Then you also have House File 4411. Would you like to move that House File 4411 be laid over for possible inclusion in an omnibus bill?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Okay, thanks. And would you like to move the DE1 amendments?
I would, Mr. Chair.
Okay, I think that'll put the bill in the like in the shape you'd like. Any discussion to the DE1 amendment? Okay, seeing none, all those in favor, please say aye.
Aye.
Aye. Opposed? Okay, the motion prevails. Representative Greenman, to your bill as amended.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. What this is doing is two things, but just to explain the amendment first, what this is doing, there's currently two accounts, and it moved because we passed last year, we passed the voter account, which has a distribution to counties and cities that we worked with the counties and cities to enact, and this what this does is move another account into the voting equipment account into the voter account. So it is the amendment does not change the amount of resources. It just consolidates it and makes it easier and more efficient to administer. The $5 million in 2024 and $5 million in 2025 are what I would say is a down payment on the conversation we've been having with our local elections administrations about this commitment that we made last year to supporting local elections administration. Last year, the voter account was the first time in Minnesota history where we made that commitment, and this would add what will be a busy election year, as we heard from our elections administrators, $5 million in one-time money in 2024 and $5 million in 2025.
Thank you. I understand Secretary Simon would like to speak briefly to this one. Sure. Welcome back to the committee, Secretary Simon. Please identify yourself.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members. I'll be quick. Last year, you passed this new voter fund. You created this new voter fund, which for the first time in Minnesota state history since 1858, recognized that there ought to be some permanent source of state support to offset costs for elections administration. I think all of you know, you talk to your local folks, the cost of administering local elections has really skyrocketed in recent years. It's fitting that we're talking about this the day after the presidential nominating primary. You have a lot of tired and sleepy election administrators wherever you live, wherever you're from. I'm glad Representative Davis is here because I appreciated he mentioned that he does, and I know he does. He reaches out to his local elections administrators. I'm sure the same is true in his district as well, because I know some of those folks. And so this is a tried and true formula that we've had for many years, and this acknowledges the work that those local folks do tirelessly year after year, election after election. Let me just give you an example about how last year this money was distributed. It was $1.25 million. That's not a lot of money for 87 counties. The formula is one that the counties and cities have bought into. In fact, they are the ones that crafted it, and I think it's fair. So Big Stone County received $3,761, but a larger county like Anoka County received $67,239. What this bill does is it consolidates other funds to make sure there's more money in there to spread around. This is not a buyout. This is not an attempt by the state to pay for all elections-related costs on the local level, and I've never met a local election administrator who has ever asked that. They're not asking for you and for the state to pay for everything. They're just asking for a reasonable and consistent offset so that they can plan and they can budget for expenses in the years to come with elections. So thank you, members, for what I hope is a continuation of the broad bipartisan support that you granted last year in creating this fund.
Thank you for your testimony. Matt Helgert, welcome back to the committee. Please identify yourself and proceed with your testimony.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. Good to be back. And I'm consolidating testimony on behalf of Alex Hassel, the League of Minnesota Cities, and myself, Matt Helgert, the Association of Minnesota Counties. I would echo the gratitude that Secretary of State Steve Simon just stated and thank Representative Greenman and this committee. Last year was a down payment on that conversation, and $1.25 million might seem de minimis, but I will tell you this. At the Minnesota Association of County Officers annual conference, this is the most popular topic. It gets resounding standing ovations, and people are very excited about it because it represents a commitment. It represents a commitment that says no matter where you are across the entire state, your tax base should not dictate how you can spend money on your election mandates. Your mandate to administer one of the most significant rights that anyone has. And so we really want to thank the legislature for starting that. It's a big, as Secretary of State Simon mentioned, we're not assuming the state will pick up 100% of costs of elections, but that was a significant move that you did, and we want to appreciate it. And we thank Representative Greenman for continuing that conversation and trying to put some more money into that account. So thank you all.
Thank you. Are there any members of the public who wish to testify on this bill? Seeing none, Representative Plum.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. And with in relation to this, there are proposals that we've been looking at about having new polling locations triggered fairly close to the election. And my concern is availability and lead time for additional equipment. And so as this, you know, moves on, I hope the Secretary of State's office looks at how they could effectively assist if we do pass into law, you know, these additional polling locations popping up at universities and other locations. But I did audit my local election yesterday, and they're doing a great job.
As is mine. Thank you, Representative Guam. And this is being laid over, so there will be an opportunity to keep having discussions on this. Representative Torkelson, you look like you might have a comment.
Thank you, Mr. Chair. The mechanics of the financing here, it looks to me like you're moving money from some existing accounts. Are those accounts not needed? And then also, it looks like there's a new general fund appropriation, so we're spending the surplus, which will increase the deficit.
Yeah. Representative Greenman, we can also go to Helen Roberts.
Yeah, so I think that there was a policy question in there, and then I'm going to turn it to Ms. Roberts to explain how it works. We're moving an account that is more restrictive into this more flexible account for the counties, and so they can use what they can currently use that older account that's been there for longer. They can use when we move the money, they can use it on that, but they can they also have more flexibility. And I'll turn it over to Helen.
Sure.
Mr. Chair and members, just real quickly, and there's a spreadsheet that outlines this. There are, as mentioned, the consolidation actually of two accounts, the voter equipment grant account and then the local government Dropbox grants. That's a total of $1.75 million. Dollars that exists currently in the Secretary of State's general fund appropriation, but now it's being redirected to the voter account. The second piece is the existing $1.25 million per year in the voter account, and that in the 23 session was written as a separate transfer, and this is just moving that into the Secretary of State's office so it is clear who has responsibility for that. And then the third piece is the additional $5 million per year for this grant program. And then you can see there's a new rider on lines 2.17 to 2.21 that totals the amount that will be moving to the voter account. It's really a total of $8 million. The reason there's a difference in 2024 is that the 2024 Vega account money, $750,000, is sitting in a special revenue account. It's not in the general fund, so we're just moving it from one account to another.
Thank you. And to your question, Representative Torkelson, about the general fund, too, we don't have a budget target or anything at this point, so it's being laid over, and we'll see what we have to work with, I guess. Any additional questions? All right. Thank you. Representative Greenman, any closing remarks?
Thank you, Mr. Chair. I think that hopefully this is a bill that we could all support. We all, and as I think you, Representative Com, mentioned, check in and understand how important the work that our local elections administrators and those election judges, how important their work is and how hard they're working. And this is an opportunity for us to invest in that work and invest in the things and the resources they need to continue running our elections. So with that, Mr. Chair, I'd ask for your support to include it in the omnibus bill.
Okay. With that, the bill is laid over. And seeing no additional questions, we are adjourned.